Historian Laurel Thatcher Ulrich. Laurel Thatcher Ulrich's 1990 book, A Midwife's Tale, opened a window into a brand new perspective on Maine and U.S. history. The perspective of a woman who would otherwise have been invisible to history. Ulrich spent years with the diary of Martha Ballard, a midwife in Hollowell, Maine in the post-revolutionary era. Through it, she learned about the real lives of families in that time, the barter economy, the hardship. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Ulrich is a pioneer in the study of women's history and is also the author of the famous quote, "Well-behaved women seldom make history." She is in Maine to deliver a keynote address at UMaine's Bicentennial Conference tomorrow evening. Women and history next on Maine Calling. But first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios in Bangor, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Historians have the power to shed light on some of the little-known stories of who we are. Laurel Thatcher Ulrich has done just that through her pioneering research and writing about the history of women in America, the history of New England, and of early America. She's here to share some of that knowledge with us today. Historian, author, and scholar Laurel Thatcher Ulrich joins me in our Bangor studio. She is perhaps most broadly known for the phrase, "Well-behaved women seldom make history," but also for her Pulitzer Prize-winning book, A Midwife's Tale, which was the basis of a PBS documentary. She is the 300th anniversary... Are you still... You retired last year. The 300th anniversary professor at Harvard University.
I am university professor emerita.
Aha. As of June. Anyway, yeah. Professor at Harvard University and past president of the American Historical Association. And she's here in Maine to give a talk as part of our state's bicentennial events. Welcome.
I'm glad to be here.
As always, we want to hear from you in the audience. What aspects of women's history do you have questions about? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Professor Ulrich, you've spent a lifetime writing about women's lives, but your own life is pretty amazing. I understand that you did not set out to become a historian or a Harvard professor. Tell us how you came to this work.
By accident, but you know, when things happen that you don't expect, you look back and think maybe it was destiny, maybe it was supposed to happen. I think even as a young person, I was very intrigued with the past, not with formal history, but stories, you know, that my grandparents and my parents told. But I always wanted to write. And so, rather logically, I ended up as an English major in college and even had a master's degree in English before I ever took a history course.
Oh, you didn't even take a history class?
No, I took, you know, government and philosophy and other social sciences, but I didn't really know much about history as a formal discipline until I was at the University of New Hampshire.
And you were at the University of New Hampshire because your husband was teaching there.
I was there, yes.
And you had five kids and you started a PhD program?
Yeah. I mean, you know, you're in a small college town and, you know, tuition break as a faculty wife. And I, you know, kind of wandered into a terrific course and then took another one. But the underlying theme was for me always writing. And it occurred to me, in part because of the kind of professors I had at UNH, historians are writers. Charles Clark, Derrett Ruttman, the two mentors that really directed my graduate work, had both been journalists, and they were both very, very serious about writing. And things just began to fall into place for me as I began to think about history in new ways, not as a chronicle of, you know, presidents and wars, but really as a story about ordinary people. And for me, a story about women really hadn't been told. And so I had a kind of mission laid out for me to do something about that.
Did your PhD advisors encourage you to study the lives of women?
They let me study the lives of women. I mean, they weren't opposed, but, you know, who was I? I was a faculty wife. I was doing this as kind of an avocation. I think if I had been in a much more high-powered, famous graduate program like Harvard, it never would have happened. In fact, I don't really have to guess about that because I know from the writings of a number of wonderful historians who were at Harvard about the time I was at UNH that they were strongly discouraged from studying this field that didn't quite exist yet of women's history.
Yes, you were kind of a radical, but you didn't quite realize it, did you?
No. No, I knew I cared about women's issues, and I had been, you know, informally in my own life and in my religious community and in my neighborhood, very engaged with issues of feminism as they were developing in the early 70s. And so it was kind of for me, a kind of miracle that suddenly I realized that writing and writing history would be a way to make a contribution.
Well, your book, The Midwife's Tale, won the Pulitzer Prize and made you famous. But here in Maine, many people have a very personal connection to it. How did you come upon Martha Ballard's diary?
Again, it's one of those examples of serendipity. Although, as I often said to my students, you know, serendipity doesn't strike in the shower. It hits you when you're doing something else and then stumble on something new. So I had finished my dissertation. I had published my first book, Good Wives, which was a history of women in northern New England before 1750. And I thought, well, here I am. I'm still in Durham. I still have 5 children. What will I do next? And I thought perhaps I would do a sequel and start from 1750 and go forward. I came to Augusta, to the state archives there, to look up an interesting court case that had long intrigued me. And it took me about 20 minutes to discover there really wasn't much in the archive. And so I thought, I wonder what else is here. And I went across the corridor to the state library and found there were 2 diaries by women in the state library. One of them turned out to be a 10-page typescript, and the other was Martha Ballard's diary, which was astounding to me because my first book had been based on little snippets of information that came from court records or sermons or records kept by men. And here were 27 years in the handwriting of one woman.
I understand that others had looked at this diary and thought, oh, this is useless. But you saw something else in it.
Yeah, I think it had been mainly used by genealogists, and the people who had looked at it had really not looked at the original diary. They'd looked at a much condensed transcription published in an Augusta town history. And, you know, they thought it was just filled with trivia and you know, birth records, but nothing that was really worth exploring further.
If you look at the pages of the original, it seems kind of cryptic. She had her own system for keeping track of things. How did you make sense of this diary? I mean, you couldn't ask her. What was your system? What were you doing here?
Well, it was a long process. And it wasn't easy, but I applied some of the techniques that I had used in graduate school, including a little bit of quantification. This is before the age of microcomputers. I created these data sheets, which I intended at some point to enter into, you know, punch cards that would go in a mainframe computer. I mean, by the time I finished the book, there were better methods to use. But I did a lot of trying to look for systematic patterns in the diary. And that was a very good idea because I then, when I dived into understanding particular stories or particular events or even particular practices of Martha as a healer and midwife, I was then able to go back and say, how was this the same? How did it deviate from earlier things? And it was through that patterning, discovering each diarist has their own system. And until I understood Martha's system, I didn't really know what was important and what wasn't important. It's when people deviate from their normal pattern that, you know, something interesting is happening here.
It's so interesting because you still don't know why she kept a diary, correct?
No. I think there's a very good argument that it began as a very bland a birth record. People sometimes needed to prove they had been born in a certain town. And so midwives, physicians sometimes kept records. There weren't very good town records. And so that became important. But then I think she was really captured by her pen. And she began to include more information.
So for those in our audience who have not read A Midwife's Tale or didn't see the PBS American Experience film that many years ago, tell us, who was Martha Ballard?
Martha Ballard was a woman born in Oxford, Massachusetts in 1720s. She migrated to Maine with her husband during the American Revolution. So she ended up in what became the capital of Maine, Augusta, but by then it was, you know, kind of a rough and tumble town with a lot of shipping of lumber out of the backcountry. And she became a midwife, I think, because she'd had some experience perhaps with her grandmother or another relative in her town in Massachusetts. But when she's up there, she's needed. And she does begin her work as a midwife shortly after arriving in Maine, but she doesn't begin the diary for a few years. Interestingly, the diary begins as she turns 50, and there may have been something symbolic for her about that, a new life.
Well, you know, we're talking, I'm going to go to a Facebook message at this point because I love this. This is from Hildy. She says, I live in central Maine and I'm often in Hollowell. When I see the Kennebec River in various conditions from floods to frozen, I think of Martha Ballard rowing across the river to get a delivery. When I find myself in tight situations, I think, what would Martha Ballard do? Thank you, Professor Ulrich, for your books and research. And that is a big part of the story, that she was not catching an Uber ride to someone's home to help deliver a baby.
No.
It was really treacherous a lot of the time.
Yes, and the river is a central character. And of course, the river's changed because there's now a dam. But the flood time in the spring, I mean, she talks about crossing the river on cakes of ice as it begins to break up in the spring. You just can hardly imagine. She used a canoe. She crossed on the ice in the dead of winter. And sometimes, you know, there were circumstances when it was very dangerous. She would be on the wrong side of the river, and someone would reach her about an emergency. And I, you know, there's this wonderful entry when she sort of describes even the swollen streams that feed into the river in the springtime could be dangerous. And she uses this phrase, a great sea a-going. And you can just kind of imagine, is she going to make it or not?
She, because of her position as a midwife, she was privy to the most intimate details of almost everyone in her community. And that's part of what makes her such a wonderful subject for a historian, isn't it?
Yes, and that's an area, of course, where counting things sort of turned out to be quite interesting, because I kept a detailed record, transcribed every birth entry, and then I could reconstruct family relationships and correlate those with marriage records. And so one of the great surprises and interesting surprises was that a large proportion of first births in Martha Ballard's practice were born to women who had become pregnant only a few months, sometimes a few weeks, occasionally a day or two before their marriage. And it helped me to think in different ways about concepts of sexuality and ideas about morality in that frontier period. This is not unheard of generally in the 18th and early 19th century, but the issue was not so much that a person became pregnant before marriage. The issue was that they married, that the father of the child was a responsible person and would marry a woman he had slept with. And there may have been some kind of implicit engagement in many of these cases, but sometimes not. And far more common than we realize. So the most dramatic moment regarding these early births was the one where Martha, following the legal system of the time, asked a laboring woman, who is the father of your child? And Sally responds, your son Jonathan is the father of my child. Well, Martha knew that, but nevertheless, she had to go through the formality. And Martha's son Jonathan had been reluctant to marry Sally, but Sally had sworn out a charge in the county court, and Martha had validated that by taking testimony at the height of labor, and they were married.
Well, I want to ask you if you could ask Martha Ballard a question, what it will be, but I have to go to a break. I also want to ask you about that famous quote. We're speaking with Laurel Thatcher Ulrich. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Otelco Cloud and Managed Services, helping Maine businesses manage IT systems and business communication. Learn more at otelco.com.
On the next Fresh Air, New York Times Supreme Court correspondent Adam Liptak talks about the court's direction on abortion, the role the court might play in challenges to President Trump, and how the court is changing with Trump's two appointees, Justices Gorsuch and Kavanaugh. Join us.
Fresh Air is this evening at 7 here on Maine Public Radio. Thinking about donating your used vehicle to Maine Public? Doing so from now through the end of June is a good time. Not only will it be towed away for free, and you could get a possible tax credit, but also our friends at Lee Auto Malls will provide a $500 Lee certificate for use towards the purchase of any new or used vehicle at any Lee Auto Malls location around the state. For complete information, please visit mainpublic.org and click on the banner or click on the events dropdown. Thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, I'm speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning author, professor, and historian Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, whose focus is on the history of women in America, as well as New England's early history. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, and post to our Facebook page. And I need to mention that you are in Maine, up here in the Bangor area, because tomorrow evening you're speaking at the University of Maine Orono as part of the state's centennial conference. So, and that event is open to the public. So if anybody would like to see you and Alan Taylor, who was speaking here on Maine Calling yesterday, that's tomorrow at 5. So before the break, I said, I'm going to ask you, what would you ask Martha Ballard if you could speak with her today, if you could go back in time?
Well, probably many things. But one of the things that I posited about Martha had to do with a sensational trial in which she participated, in which the wife of the deposed minister of the community had accused one of the local justices of the peace of rape. And it was a complicated case. Martha took down and wrote in her diary what the minister's wife had told her. And then later she wrote what she had said when she testified in court. Not surprisingly, the justice of the peace was acquitted. And Martha wrote in her diary, Judge North acquitted to the surprise of everyone I heard speak of it. There's not a good trial record. So, you know, I can't fully reconstruct that case. But for Martha, she was surprised that he was acquitted. And I concluded, again, by this sort of looking at patterns in her diary, this had a real impact on her, that it was a form of disillusionment for her, because she essentially quit going to church.
Hmm.
For some period of time, she eventually went back, but there had been a conflict in the community over this particular pastor, the husband of the woman, who appears to have been almost gang raped.
Hmm.
So it was just a horrible story about which we know nothing except that there was a trial, he was acquitted, and what Martha said in the diary. But for her, it was more than just that case. It was about a kind of rift in the community in which a vulnerable woman had been made a victim because of conflicts and the power of a man.
Donna in Randolph, I believe, has a question about Martha Ballard. Hi, Donna. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, my name is Donna Porter, and I was a museum educator at Old Fort Weston in Augusta. And I have met Dr. Ulrich a long time ago, but most of my research on Martha has been through the diary itself that was transcribed by Robert and Cynthia McCausland. And my question is, because in my other life, I was a nurse, so I'm interested in her medical, and I wonder if you could tell me, do you have any theories on why Martha Ballard had such a good record on her delivery of children? She delivered over 1,000, and she didn't lose. She has better record than modern doctors, some modern doctors.
Well, not quite, but she certainly had excellent records for her period. Babies died, but she didn't lose anybody in any mother in
wow.
delivery. And that really is remarkable. And I think there are a number of explanations. One is she was very experienced. Experience matters, as we know. But also, it was a pretty young population. And I think it was a population where people basically, even though it was kind of a rough area, they had enough to eat. And they were physically active. They were strong. They also, these women had a lot of babies. And I think statistically, if there's going to be trouble, often it shows up in an early delivery. And women who successfully delivered once, often, I don't want to be rigid about this because I'm not a medical expert, but from my reading, it has a lot to do with the population, with their general health, and with Martha Ballard's skill. Having said that, the dangers in her practice, which included general health care as well as midwifery, came from infection and infectious diseases. So there were some deaths postpartum because of infection, particularly in a period when there was a lot of strep, what we would recognize now as probably streptococcus infections. So we need to always contextualize this in terms of broader patterns of healthcare and general health.
Donna, thanks so much for your call. If you have a question for Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We haven't talked about your famous quote yet.
Okay.
Well-behaved women seldom make history. We've all seen that on bumper stickers with your name on it. That you did not write that, I read, as a rallying cry. You did not read that to encourage all women to misbehave. It was an entirely different context, right?
Well, it actually came from my first published historical work, which was an article in American Quarterly, a scholarly journal, on Puritan funeral sermons, if you can imagine. And in the first paragraph, just leading into my topic, I just emphasized, they went to church even when it rained. They were good women. They didn't ask to be remembered, and they haven't been. Well-behaved women seldom make history. So what I was really writing about is the way people in most societies ignore women who really hold up half the sky, the well-behaved women who make things happen, who care for others. They sort of ignore them. Historians have followed suit and pretty much ignore them. So I was making an argument in that article for the importance of studying ordinary women, those who didn't show up in court records or don't show up in, books and essays, women whose lives had been forgotten. I have to say, however, that when this particular quotation was kind of lifted out of that scholarly article, many years later, actually, after the publication of A Midwife's Tale, when I had some name recognition and a journalist was reading my early work and was very astute. I mean, she picked that quote out and used it as the epigraph for her own book. This was the journalist Kay Mills. It was really a work of genius that she saw the potential in that quotation. And I love the many, many ways that quotation has been reinterpreted and used and has inspired women of all kinds to do many kinds of things to really reclaim the importance of women in history.
Why do you think it reverberated as it did?
I think it was the time. It was the internet. you know, it went onto the internet. A young woman started selling T-shirts, and then other people started selling T-shirts. So it was really the mid-90s. See, it was 20 years after I wrote the article. And a lot was happening. I think that first wave of feminism from the 70s that ended rather dismally with the defeat of the ERA, I think there was a new generation sort of rediscovering women's issues and really wanting to think about ways they could make a difference.
Do you think it's partially the word choice, well-behaved women? Because you wouldn't say well-behaved men.
No. You're right. It's the stereotype of, yeah. Oh, don't, you know, and we're living, of course we're living with that today in our own society, we know.
And yet she persisted.
Yes.
We'll go to Charlie, who's calling from South Portland. Hi, Charlie, go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, I was wondering if Martha had any siblings and if we know anything about them.
Yes, I do. Two of her siblings are really quite interesting to think about. She had more than that, but the two that are most vivid, her brother Jonathan Moore, her maiden name was Moore, Jonathan Moore actually became a minister, a pastor. He went to Harvard College. And it's kind of interesting as I wonder how Martha learned how to write. Not all women did that, and she could read well. I just wonder if she may have profited somewhat from having that brother who was educated and went on. He had a much less distinguished life than she did, actually. But then her other sister, very dear sister, was the grandmother of Clara Barton, the woman who founded the American Red Cross. She remained in Massachusetts, where Clara Barton was born, in the same town that Martha Ballard was born in. And Clara was quite aware of her grandmother's illustrious sister.
And she wrote about having tea and how much she liked Martha Ballard.
Yeah, that's right.
That's wonderful. Charlie, thanks so much for that question. We'll go to Tad, who's also calling from South Portland. Hi, Tad. Go ahead. Tad, go ahead. Yeah, we can't hear you, Tad. So maybe you can try back. So the number 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You wrote A Midwife's Tale in 1990, almost three decades ago. What have we learned about women in that period of Maine's history, of American history, that you didn't know then? What do you know now? What do you wish you had known then?
That's kind of a hard question. Because you've made it very specific to Maine. I mean, I think the number one theme that in general has been transformative in history. I mean, there are a couple of important themes that have been transformative in the history of women in the last 30 years. But one of the most important is to try to move beyond white women and to really understand the complexities, the very complex relationships between what has come to be called gender, which is the social construction of sexual difference, and race. So gender as a theme certainly hasn't eliminated a focus on women as a category of analysis, but it's complicated because there are multiple genders, multiple ways of constructing differences between the sexes, And gender also shapes men's lives as well as women's lives. I think those of us working in the 80s were doing a lot of that. But there's now a theoretical perspective that's really helpful to think about gender and to think about it as a category of analysis. The current word is intersections. The intersection between various categories by which we define a population. So I'm not only a woman, I'm an 80-year-old woman. I'm a mother, I'm a grandmother. I'm white. So race, age, religion, ethnicity, class, all of those relationships matter. And in the abstract, that might lead to very interesting sociological questions. But in the actual practice of the kind of history that interests me, it pushes us. It pushes the boundaries of who we look at. My 2001 book, for example, which is called The Age of Homespun, is a kind of ironic title for a book that actually is doing a lot of those intersections. So when I wrote about Maine, one of the central figures was not a Martha Ballard, but an Abnaki woman called Molly Ockett. And what was interesting to me was to try to understand how gender, religion, and race, as well as the horrendous experiences of war in early Maine, shaped Molly Ockett's life.
I didn't know you'd written about Molly Ockett. Tell us about her.
She was a woman who was born in the 18th century, in early 18th century, actually fairly close to the earlier, to the decades in which Martha Ballard's life was taking shape. Her people, the Pequawkats, were just really under siege from English settlement. And Molly was in a situation in the middle of the 18th century where, as a little girl, she was actually not taken captive. Her family went to the Maine government and said, we're in the midst of a war. The French were involved. Other American Indians were involved. We don't want to take sides. Can't you protect us? And the way they protected them was to move them onto an island and then later into a little enclave in southern Massachusetts and kind of keep them in this sequestered area until the end of the war. And through that experience, Molly, or her baptismal name in a French Catholic church may have been Marie, but Molly learned English. And that had a strong impact when she was able finally to go back into Maine. And she lived out her life in central Maine and became, she would move back and forth across the border into French Canada. And she created one of the most important artifacts in any Maine public collection, which replicated some ancient twining techniques with moose hair embroidery that most people thought had disappeared. But she helped to preserve that technology.
We're speaking with Laurel Thatcher Ulrich. We're going to take one more quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Androscoggin Home, Healthcare, and Hospice, announcing a new office and expanded services in Augusta. For health, for life. Androscoggin.org. If you enjoy the InTune programs with Sarah Willis, a reminder that we have a 24/7 online stream of InTune programming for whenever and wherever you'd like. To listen, please visit our website, mainepublic.org, Click on Listen Live and choose the InTune option, or click on Radio and then InTune. It's also available on the Maine Public app. Enjoy. Coming up today at 2 is the Commonwealth Club of California. Glenn and Jesse Close bring change to mind. Award-winning actor and advocate Glenn Close founded the nonprofit Bring Change to Mind to change the way mental illness is perceived after her sister Jessie was diagnosed as bipolar and her nephew with schizoaffective disorder. That's coming up today at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, we are discussing early American history and women's history with Laurel Thatcher Ulrich. Join our conversation. Give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. I understand that for a time you were president of the American Historical Association, and I was so interested in something that you were talking about at the time, and it's so parallel to what journalists are always looking for, open records and transparency. I didn't realize that that is something that's of such foremost importance to historians as well, that sometimes archives are closed, even here in the U.S. Why?
Well, there are lots of reasons. In private archives, the people who contribute them sometimes put restrictions on them. No one can look at this until 75 years after I die, for example. And public records, I think probably in the American Historical Association, we had a great deal of attention dealing with federal archives because of issues of secrecy, things that are, you know, classified information. And so there was kind of constant process of people coming in and asking for help to try to get access to documents and developing policies, developing for support for scholars who are trying to have access to materials. Other kinds of materials that are often closed are materials having to do with private life, public or sometimes held by religious communities. There's so much attention right now to corporate archives, to religious archives having to do with cases of abuse. How are these handled? What kind of payments are being made? Well, those things have historical context. I mean, it's kind of interesting, going back to my earlier point about the trial in Maine. There's no documentation in the trial record of any of the testimony. The only reason I know what Martha Ballard said in that trial is because she wrote it down in her diary. And that may have been because of bad record keeping. It may also have been because the accused person was a judge and may have had good reason to try to not preserve, his colleagues.
The record may have disappeared.
It may have disappeared. So archives are really important. But archives, and I really want to emphasize this a lot, Martha Ballard didn't have to hand her diary on as it was to her descendants. There are a lot of unpleasant things about her family in there and about her relationship, for example, with one of her sons. Somehow she trusted her family enough to hand it on. And they cared enough about her to take care of it and to preserve it, even when for 100 years, nobody thought it was really important except to the family. So some of the most important things to historians are actually private papers that end up in a public repository where they can be used and accessed by historians. It takes a great deal of public spiritedness and self-confidence, I think, to archive your family papers.
You've said history is dangerous.
It's very dangerous. It changes the way we think about the world. You know, when we uncover things that were not meant to be uncovered, it changes our perception, and we act differently. I mean, there are so many examples of that in the present day. I've been recently watching that Netflix series called The Keepers. I don't know how many of you looked at it. It's a heart-rending story about ordinary people. A woman who was murdered in Baltimore, and she had been a teacher. And in some of her students, you know, 25, 30, 40 years later, who say, we want to know more about that, and are actually uncovering records that did not survive otherwise.
We'll go to Bruce calling from Harpswell. Hi, Bruce. Go ahead.
Hi. Your book touched on two things that were kind of close to my life. One was Dr. Vaughn, who was, I think, one of two physicians in the area. And the other was on a family that was Unitarian and behaved very strangely. I'd be interested in what you would say about Martha Ballard's relation with the physicians and anything about the Unitarians. Thanks.
Okay. Let me take the second one first, because I think you're talking about a universalist, which is a slight distinction here. And there were many kinds of universalism in that period. But the universalist I'm sure you're talking about was a man named, I think, James Purrington. His last name was Purrington, who essentially killed his family. And therefore kind of gave universalists a bad name, inappropriately, we should add. But Martha Ballard was a neighbor to that family, and she had the experience of helping to lay out the bodies. It's a powerful example of family violence not being a recent invention, nor insanity being a problem only of the modern world. It's a horrendous and very famous story about early Augusta, Maine. The other question about the physicians, actually, Dr. Vaughn was a loyalist from a loyalist family, connected to some of the great proprietors in Maine, very much an elite family in the Hollowell, Maine. I'm not familiar that he did much actual practice of medicine during Martha Ballard's life. He advised some of the other local physicians. Dr. Coney, in particular, was the one who was closest to Martha, and then there were a couple of new physicians who weren't very skilled as they began their work. But in this period, she really had the corner on midwifery and sort of general health care, and it was really after her death that in this part of Maine, physicians really moved in a significant way into the practice of obstetrics.
Bruce, thank you so much for your question. I can't let you go this hour without asking you, since you've written about American women's lives for more than 30 years now, Laurel, I want to ask you about your reflections on the Me Too movement and the moment we're in right now.
Yes. Well, I have two reflections on that, and they come from many directions and from my long experience going back into the 70s, when many of us thought we'd solve some of these problems by promoting sexual harassment legislation, by promoting, particularly in universities, when I was first at the University of New Hampshire and the Women's Studies program was working so hard, things like Take Back the Night, other policies about sexual harassment. And somehow that went away. The laws were there, but they weren't being implemented. And why is that? Lots and lots of reasons. But one of the reasons was decline in public attention and perhaps an inability to pass on the very, very hard work of one generation into the next and the one that followed. I think maybe women became confident that the world had changed now. We have access to jobs. We have moved into the professions. Now we're in a world of equality. What we're discovering is there's still a great deal more work to be done.
You have daughters?
I have two daughters.
Good yes. feminists?
And they're good feminists. Yes, excellent feminists. And my youngest daughter is right now very, very active in her own community politically.
Well, Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, what a pleasure to have you on Maine Calling today. Again, you're speaking at the University of Maine tomorrow at 5 with Alan Taylor. I just love that you all know each other and we're working on your books about Central Maine at the same time back in the late 80s. And I'm sure the talk is going to be really terrific. That is historian, author, and scholar Laurel Thatcher Ulrich. She wrote the Pulitzer Prize winning book, A Midwife's Tale. She's been a professor at Harvard, past president of the American Historical Association. This show was part of Maine Public's coverage of Maine's bicentennial. This will be on television, radio, online, and all over the place for the next year. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Olivia Peruk took your calls. We had additional help from Steve Tilton and Rich Tozier. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.